Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Sound Health Radio. I am your guest host for the night. My name is Heather Baker. Along with me is my co-host, Nikki Byrne. Hello,
Hi,
Nikki.
Hi, everybody.
And also, we have a special guest tonight. Well, yeah, we've got a couple of them. We've got Nikki's husband with us, and we have Dr. David Clark, the author of They Can't Find Anything Wrong. Hello, Dr. Clark.
Hello, Heather. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great. We're glad to have you here. We were just listening to a song from the Cutting Crew. It was popular back in my day, back in the high school days, in 1987. Nikki here says that's a stressful song. Nikki, why is that stressful for you?
Well, they say it must have been something you said. It must have been something you did. So, I don't know. It stresses me. Somebody's doing something bad to them.
Okay, Dr. Clark, glad to have you aboard. We've got some emails here, and we've got some questions for some listeners already, but first we got some announcements Nikki's going to share with us. Nikki, can you tell us a little bit about what's been going on this week?
This week we had our first professional focus weekend course. It went really, really well. I think our students got a lot out of it, and they're going to have... we're doing one a month for 3 months, and they're going to have some time to practice and be ready for the next class. And I think it was a big success.
That's great. That's great. We've started something for our professionals, like Nikki said, that people can join in on the weekends instead of weeks straight. We always have a focus class every month. Nikki, when is our next focus class?
Our October class starts on the 15th through the 19th, and our November course is the 12th through the 16th.
If you want some more information about our classes and how to join, you can check out our website at www.nutrasound.com. If you have any questions for us about our class or about our topic tonight or for Dr. Clark, Nikki, can you give our listeners the call-in numbers?
Anybody wants to call in the U.S., it's 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. And in Canada, it's 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756.
Okay, Dr. Clark, getting back to you, I'm going to read our listeners a little bit of your biography here. Dr. David Clark received his BA in psychology from Williams College, Phi Beta Kappa, and his medical degree from the University of Connecticut in 1979. Since then, he has successfully cared for thousands of patients with stress illness, often sent to him after other doctors were unable to help them. He's also been a visiting professor at several international hospitals, including Oxford. He was also named a top doctor in the Portland Monthly Magazine Physician Review in 2005 and 2006. That's great.
Thank you.
Dr. Clark has received numerous awards for excellence in patient care. He's developed and presented a monthly seminar on stress illness, and local doctors have given their patients 50,000 copies of his brochure on this topic. And you live in Happy Valley, Oregon. That's appropriate.
Yeah, I thought so. Although then I found out that it was named that in the 19th century because there was a saloon and bordello there. So, I don't know what that
happiness
means.
Happiness, huh?
Yeah.
That's great. Now, Dr. Clark, I don't know if you're familiar with our station or not. We've got a lot of listeners who really care intensely about their own health and health options, and a lot of people are looking for alternative answers modern medical problems.
Yeah.
How did you get into the stress illness related type field?
Well, you know, it all started with one patient. I was cruising along in my medical training at UCLA. I was just I had 7 years down and two more to go, and I thought I pretty well knew a lot. And then all of a sudden, I encountered this one patient that all of my training was completely useless in terms of helping her. And I guess that was true for a number of other doctors as well, because she'd been ill for 2 years. She'd seen two internal medicine doctors and six gastrointestinal specialists and had been evaluated at two universities, and nobody had been able to find anything wrong with her. Nobody had come up with an effective treatment, and all of a sudden I realized that there was a whole lot I didn't know. But I accidentally stumbled on the fact that she had a significant stress in her life. It happened to be a stress that had happened to her when she was a child. She had suffered a lot of abuse up until the age of 12. But now she was 37, 25 years later, and she was suddenly taken ill. And so I had no idea if there was any connection between these two things. But there was a doctor at UCLA at that time who was interested in issues like this. She was a psychiatrist who also had board certification in internal medicine, and so I sought her out. Her name was Harriet Kaplan, and she came to see this patient, and that was the last I saw or heard of them for several months. And then I saw Dr. Kaplan in an elevator, and I asked how the patient Catherine was doing, and she said, "Catherine's fine. All of her problems have gone away." And I got off the elevator, and I turned around, and I said, "Dr. Kaplan, how did you do that?" And because nothing in my training had prepared me for such a thing. I had no idea you could make a serious illness go away just by talking to somebody. And Dr. Kaplan, a little later, started my training in this area, and it wasn't long before I was helping people in ways I'd never imagined before.
Wow.
And now we're 7,000-plus patients later.
That's great. I've got your book right here in front of me, and I've also got it up on our part on BBS Radio and on Nutrisounds as well. I really like your book. It's really written for everyday people. It's a nice read. It's really informative.
Thank you. The heart of the book is about four dozen stories selected from all those thousands of patients, and it's designed to help people see this issue from every angle. Because these are patients who have, two big challenges in front of them. Number one, the stress is usually something that they're not consciously aware of, at least not fully. And so it's hard for them to perceive the whole of what's going on. And second, the stresses involved don't cause any visible damage to the body. So when we go to do diagnostic tests, there's nothing to be found. And unfortunately, most doctors have no formal training in where to go next, what questions to ask, or what to look for.
Great. At the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology, which is our facility, we are actually underway with a study involving GABA receptors right now. Nikki, can you tell us a little bit about that study?
I personally have a problem with depression and anxiety, and I worked in a highly stressful field, and I was taking medication. I was taking Zoloft, and it caused me to gain a lot of weight.
Yes.
And the side effect of that was deeper depression.
Right.
I felt so bad. So we started a study here and found that I was lacking GABA. So you can take a supplement for GABA. So I started that, and then GABA was high in my system. So we had to go even deeper and found that there's three receptors in the body for GABA, and they were clogged, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had to decode those receptors and find the frequency equivalent and get those receptors working again. And I haven't taken Zoloft in 4 months. And I feel really good.
Dr. Clark, how do you feel about medication for depression or anxiety?
Well, I think that depression and anxiety are disorders that sometimes benefit from medication and sometimes do not. And you always have to be careful because any medication can have side effects. And you always want to find a situation where the patient is going to have significantly more benefit from the medication than they are side effects from the medication. And many times there are patients who are suffering a deficiency of a neurotransmitter in the central nervous system, and the medications for anxiety and depression are believed to work by replenishing those missing neurotransmitters. And in a person who's deficient in those, we're essentially trying to bring their nervous system back into balance the way nature intended. Nature, for example, in diabetes, you develop a deficiency in insulin, and we try to give insulin back to the body so that it can function more the way it was designed to. And that's the same kind of principle with which we use medications for anxiety and depression, but they're not appropriate for everybody, and they don't work for everybody. So it takes a lot of judgment and experience to prescribe them appropriately.
Now, what happens if you go to see your doctor and the doctor can't find anything physically wrong with you? Can they benefit from reading your book?
Yes. If you had your symptoms evaluated by a healthcare professional, it's always, and there's nothing found, there's always, it's possible that there's a visible cause, and you always have to bear that in mind. But at the same time, while an evaluation may be ongoing for visible or what some people call physical causes of the illness, you can be looking into these other areas, and that's what the book is designed to help people to do. Like as I mentioned earlier, there are about 4 dozen stories from my practice, plus some more explanatory information that can help people to look into their own lives for sources of stress that the brain then can turn into nerve signals that go into the body and cause physical symptoms. And then if you find an area that looks like it applies to your own personal situation, you can go back to your healthcare professional and say, look, you know, I found this in the book. I think it might apply to me. What do you think? You can collaborate with your doctor. And most doctors are going to be delighted if you find a potential alternative solution to the symptoms that you're having in the book. I should mention that the symptoms that people can get from stress can be almost anything from head to toe. Headaches, lump in the throat, stiffness and pain in the neck and shoulder muscles, chest pain, difficulty breathing, digestive difficulties, bloating, gas, diarrhea, constipation, nausea, vomiting, pelvic pain, back pain. The list is almost endless. And these are absolutely real physical symptoms. These are not imaginary or in your head.
I've got a question from Sherry here in Athens. How and why does stress raise your blood pressure?
Well, that's because the nerve signals from the stress center of the brain, the same ones that can go into the body and cause symptoms, they also can cause tightening of the muscles of the blood vessels, and that increases the pressure on the fluid within the blood vessels, and so you get higher blood pressure.
Wow, interesting. Now, are the symptoms caused by stress, are they real or just in your head?
Well, you know, I have to admit that 25 years ago, before I learned from Dr. Kaplan, I used to think, and this was the way doctors are trained, that if we couldn't find out what was wrong with you with our diagnostic test, that it was probably all in your head. We were never going to really find a diagnosis. We were not going to find a successful treatment because the basic problem for the patient was that they just weren't coping with life very well. And fortunately from Dr. Kaplan and from my thousands of patients, I've learned that not only is none of that true, the exact opposite is true. If you know the questions to ask, you can find specifically what's wrong with somebody. And there is almost always effective treatment available, and it absolutely is not in your head. Many of my patients have been so ill, they've had to be hospitalized. Some of them were ill enough that a surgeon operated on them. It unfortunately, of course, didn't do them any good, but it shows how significant the symptoms can be sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Chris joins us. Chris is Nikki's husband, and he was wanting to be a part of the show. He is in the process of changing jobs and kind of in a stressful situation. I'll let him ask his question now.
Okay.
Yeah, basically, I'm changing jobs, same field, different office, and basically less stress. But I've noticed since I've committed to making this change, I've had some trouble actually eating or having an appetite. Does stress, is that something that stress would cause?
Well, there are a number of different causes of why a person might lose their appetite, but stress is definitely one of them. It's a common symptom of stress. It can, in more severe cases, cause the stomach to slow down its emptying, which if you get even higher level of stress can cause nausea, And in the most extreme cases, I've even seen it turn into vomiting. You know, that's not necessarily going to happen to you. It all depends on the level of stress that a person is dealing with and how long it goes on for.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Dr. Clark, in your book, and once again the title is They Can't Find Anything Wrong, you talk about the five major types of stress. Can you give our audience an overview of those?
Yes, absolutely. Most common type, the one that everybody thinks of, is just stress that's going on in your life at the moment. As we just heard about the changing jobs there, that's certainly a common one. A related one was a patient of mine who, after a long discussion about exactly when his symptoms were occurring, we found out that they were occurring while he was driving to work in the morning, but lo and behold, they were not happening when he was driving home from work. So I asked him, you know, how are things on the job? And he looked at me and he said, you know, they're terrible. So that was a pretty obvious diagnosis. But another common one that occurs in a person's life at the moment is in a person who takes care of everybody else in their world but doesn't quite get around to caring for themselves. And that can catch up with you after a while, and that turns out to be a surprisingly common issue. The second major type of stress is prolonged effects of stress from childhood. I mentioned the case that turned my career around, the woman who was abused as a child, and then 25 years later she's ill. And it turns out there are actual connections there. There's a whole process that goes on with respect to recovery from child abuse that can lead people to suddenly become ill in the middle of their lives. And it took me many years and many thousands of interviews with people who had gone through that process before I felt like I understood it. And it's a big section of the book. The last three major types of stress are conditions that are considered mental health conditions, and most people have heard of them, but they don't... the popular image of these conditions is different than the reality in many cases. And these three are depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress. And many people think they know what those are, but in a majority of cases, the way they present themselves in a person is different than the popular image. For example, in depression, you may not feel particularly depressed, but the disease can cause you to sleep badly, to have poor appetite, for that matter, to be very fatigued, to lose interest in things you used to love to do, to cry more often than usual. And I've had lots of people with all those symptoms who look at me when I ask them, and they say, no, I don't feel depressed. I'm exasperated, I'm frustrated, but I'm not depressed. And yet, when we treat them with medication designed to help restore the neurotransmitter balance in their nervous systems, their symptoms improve dramatically, and so that helps to confirm the fact that they've had depression all along.
Wow.
So those are the five major types. Those are the issues that I look for. I can usually, with you know, asking questions in these areas, find that a person with otherwise undiagnosed symptoms is having a problem in at least one of those areas. And the way we confirm a diagnosis of stress illness is that if we then treat the stress that we find and the symptoms get better or go away completely, then we know we were on the right track.
What type of treatments do you discuss in your book?
Well, the treatments are all individually based on the stresses that the person is suffering. For example, if you are a person who takes care of everybody else in your world, you know, your spouse, your children, your job, your household, and never stops to really do anything for yourself, the treatment for that is to set aside 4 or 5 hours a week and learn how to do something for yourself that is so much fun you can't wait to do it again the next week.
That would be great. Me being a single mother, that's my problem right there, is just not having the time to do anything for myself, and when I actually do, I go to sleep. That's my stress reliever right
Yeah,
there.
I know, and it's very challenging, particularly for single moms. And there are some people that it's just not going to be realistic to do that, and I have to, you know, accept the fact. But if the person is physically ill from this, it's sort of their body's way of telling them that it really just can't take that lifestyle anymore. It needs some kind of a break, and maybe it doesn't have to be 4 or 5 hours, but, you know, just something that you do that's just all about you. Many of my patients who struggle with this grew up in some degree of turmoil or neglect that prevented them from being children, prevented them from having carefree playtime, because when we're children and we're doing that carefree playing, that's when we learn that essential human skill of taking care of ourselves. And if we don't learn that as children, if we're constantly having to worry about everything that's going on in our environment, we tend to be the same way as adults. We're always thinking about everything but ourselves. And again, sooner or later, your body is going to let you know that it can't keep doing that indefinitely.
Okay, I'm getting a hand signal over here from Nikki. She has a question. Nikki,
fire away.
Dr. Clark, I have to tell you, I read your book, and a lot of times when I find I'm reading a self-help book, I read the first chapter and then I kind of put it down and don't pick it up again. But I didn't put yours down. I really, really enjoyed it, and I went through it very quickly. And I had a question about the good partner bad illness. I think it was Kevin had met someone.
And yes.
Can you explain that to me a little bit more?
Yes. That's part of the process of recovery from childhood stress for many people, what I call the good partner bad illness syndrome, which seems so paradoxical and ironic that you would finally meet somebody that treats you well and with respect, and there's a lot of, you know, mutual support in the relationship, and you get back from your partner as much as you give to them, and it's really, really great, and it's the first time that a child abuse survivor has had such a person in their life, and all of a sudden they get ill right at the time that this relationship is happening, and it's kind of like, what is up with that? And it turns out that what is up with that is several things. First of all, that a lot of people, it's such a new experience to have somebody like this in their life that they're not quite sure that they trust it. You know, they're wondering if the person is going to, the partner that they're with is going to wake up one morning and say, you know, I made a big mistake here. I'm out of this relationship. You know, there's that, it's an irrational fear, but it's a fear that's there nevertheless. So that's part of the stress. But another very important part is that the longer you're with this person, the more you start to think, you know, maybe this person has a point. Maybe I really am as good a human being as they say I am. Maybe they really do want to be in a relationship with me because I am a wonderful human being who deserves to be treated well. And that's great, of course, but it inevitably turns around to the fact that if you deserve to be treated well today, it means that you probably deserved to be treated well as a child also. And so you look back and you see that you were not treated well as a child, and it's at that point that you start to feel a certain amount of resentment about how you were mistreated as a child, and that resentment begins to grow, and all of the emotions that you had to have stuffed away growing up in order to survive that difficult growing up experience, all those emotions start knocking on the door. With the support of the good partner, they are ready to finally be heard and express themselves and be felt sometimes for the first time. And that is a real tornado that hits people at this point in their lives. And it can sometimes hit extremely hard, and people get sometimes really disappointed that they felt like they'd left all that trauma behind. And all of a sudden, it's popping up again. But the truth is that at that point in their lives, they've worked through 90% of what they need to do, and they're not far away from a really good and lasting recovery from those long ago issues. But those emotions that are finally knocking on the door, they need to be expressed. They need to be written down. They need to be spoken to people. And putting them into words is the key to recovery from that. Sorry, long-winded answer, but it's a
good answer. That was a great answer.
That is amazing. I mean, the whole book just amazed me. And I felt like you just related it to the I deserve better part.
Exactly.
Can you go a little bit more into that?
Yes. You know, the common denominator in a childhood stress of all my childhood stress survivors is that, you know, if I can revert to the vernacular a little bit, the common denominator is basically that you suck. I mean, that you are a second-rate human being. And that is how all different forms of abuse find their sort of lowest common level. You know, if you were molested, if you were beaten, if you were neglected, if you were verbally abused, if there was alcoholism in the home, drug abuse, violence, neglect, never being able to measure up to parental expectations, all of those things send a message to the child that you are a second-rate human being, and the self-esteem is what suffers. But at the same time, in order to survive an environment like that, people have to pay attention to details. They have to, you know, be really wary. It's like growing up in a minefield. They've always got to be on their guard. They've always got to be thinking about stuff. So that as adults, they tend to be very detail-oriented. Some of them are perfectionists. They're also very capable of getting things done. They thrive in the workplace. I mean, they are the people who become managers and supervisors, and they're just the kind of people you want to have be your coworker or your supervisor. So they get, and I should mention, they're also compassionate. They know what it's like to suffer, and when they see that suffering in somebody else, they reach out to them and they try to help and support. And so for all these reasons, they get a lot of positive feedback from the adult world, the world of the workplace. And that helps to build their self-esteem. That helps to overcome the years of being treated negatively. And gradually over time, and it differs from person to person, they begin to develop the idea that maybe they're a reasonable human being after all. And at some point they decide, I deserve better. You know, that they may be in a bad situation in the workplace. They might be in a bad relationship. They might still be getting badly treated by their parents. And they get enough positive feedback from the rest of the world that they just decide one day, you know, it may not be a conscious decision, but sometimes an unconscious feeling that I deserve better. I am not going to put up with this crap anymore. And that's a huge shift. But also, you know, very stressful, you know, to suddenly have your whole view of yourself change by 180 degrees. And people can get ill at that point, too, because of the stress.
You know, in listening to you and in reading the book, I feel like I know all the people, all your patients that were in the book, and I could relate to them so easily. And listening to you, I can hear the caring and understanding in your voice, and that's a stress reliever.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'm so grateful to my patients because most of my learning in this area has come from them. I mean, I set aside an hour, a long appointment, to interview everyone with problems in this area, and you know, people have been very trusting, and they share you know, some of the most difficult and intimate details of their lives with me, so that I can, you know, understand that where they're coming from. And it took me, you know, 5 or 6 years after I finished my training to really sort of put all the pieces of the puzzle together and really feel like I understood what was going on. But a lot of that was from Dr. Kaplan, but even more of it, I think, was from people sharing themselves with me. It's also interesting, you said you read it all the way through. There's a well-known psychiatrist at Berkeley who said exactly the same thing.
That's wonderful. Your book is fascinating. And once again, for our audience who didn't catch the name of it, it's They Can't Find Anything Wrong, 7 Keys to Understanding, Treating, and Healing Stress Illness. What are some common symptoms of stress?
Well, I don't want to forget to mention for your listeners who wish more information, they can go to stressillness.com. But to get to your question, the symptoms, there really isn't a common denominator in the symptoms. I mean, they are medical symptoms, they're physical symptoms, just like you can get from any other disease. You know, a patient who walks in my door and tells me they have a particular symptom, I from the first moment they describe it, I can't really tell if it's from an ulcer or from stress, or if it's from a bowel disease or from stress. The symptoms are, in the first description, they're the same. If there is any kind of common denominator, it's that there's a tendency for people with stress-related illness to have more than one symptom. It's not a perfect indicator, but the more symptoms a person has, the more likely that stress is responsible, because, as I mentioned before, the symptoms are caused by the brain sending nerve signals out into the body, and it's one of the few organs, the brain, that can cause symptoms in multiple locations, all coming from the same kind of illness. So if somebody comes into me and they say they've got 4 different symptoms in 4 different places in their body, the odds are beginning to build up that it's a stress-related illness. Not necessarily, but we're beginning to have a tendency in that direction.
So if I were to go see my local physician, what types of questions would you suggest that I ask him related to stress and what kind of treatments I could seek? Or maybe I don't even realize that I have stress.
Yeah, a lot of my patients don't. I mean, part of the reason that that stress can build up to the point of making people physically ill is that the individual is not fully aware of what's going on, and so consequently they can't, you know, you can't do anything about something you don't fully understand. So that's a real challenge. And another challenge is, again, that few physicians have had formal training in the what kinds of questions to ask to ferret out what these stresses are. So I recommend that people, when they go to their doctor, they first go in and say that they have a certain number of concerns that they want to share, you know, usually 2, 3, maybe 4, because, you know, doctors today have very limited amounts of time to help people. But you want to get your major concerns across, and so you want to tell the doctor up front, I've got 2 or 3 or 4 things that I want to communicate to you, and you want to get them all across before the doctor starts firing their questions away, because the way the medical mind works is, as soon as you present a symptom, they're going to start immediately thinking of, okay, what could be causing this symptom?
Right.
And they're going to immediately want to ask you more questions to try to narrow down the list of possibilities, and they may cut you off before you get to the second thing on your list. So you have to say, well, doctor, just a minute. I want to get, you know, all 3 of my concerns out there on the table before we start investigating, because a lot of times the 3 concerns that you have are connected. And if you don't get to number 2 or 3, because the doctor goes off on number 1, it may send the doctor on a completely wrong pathway. So that's the first recommendation I would make, is to get all 3 of your concerns, or whatever number it is, but try to keep it small. Save other things for a follow-up visit. Get all of them out there, and then let the doctor do their thing. Let them get to work on it, do whatever tests they need to do, and then if they do the evaluation and they don't find anything, you can come in with the next visit and you can say, look, I read this book, and here are some issues that I found that seem to connect to my situation. What do you think? Can we do some things about this? And, you know, that's going to educate the doctor about you. It's going to let the doctor know who you are as a person and what you're struggling with in the rest of your life, and they can use that information to your benefit.
I was reading a statistic the other day. It said the average face-to-face time with your doctor is 20 minutes, and I kind of thought that was stretching it a little bit. I'm not sure. But what types of treatments do you recommend for stress? It seems like most of the doctors that I've run up against are very eager to prescribe medication as opposed to, say, an exercise program.
Yeah, the treatments that I recommend are, again, specific to the particular stress that a person is suffering from. Let's pick some examples. One of the, we talked about the long-term effects of childhood stress, and one of my favorite and most effective treatments is for people to write a letter to the individuals who treated them badly. Even if, it's not a letter to be mailed, it's just a letter to be written. One of my favorite patients was she was in sales and she was a motivational speaker, and she had irritable bowel syndrome, and she came to see me every couple of months for a few years, and she had been emotionally abused by her father, and I thought that was likely a part of her her symptoms, and I kept urging her to write a letter to her dad, again, not to be mailed, just to write it so that she could have a chance to put her feelings onto a piece of paper. So many times I find that the more emotions you put onto a piece of paper, the less need there is for those emotions to go into the body. But she wasn't interested in that, or maybe she just wasn't ready, and she always came to me with something from the internet that was a new treatment or a new test she could have, and we kind of went back and forth for a few years, and then one day she said, okay, Dr. Clark, I'm going to write two paragraphs to my dad. But if I do that, you have to promise to stop badgering me about this. So I said, I don't think two paragraphs is going to be enough after everything you've told me about your dad. And she said, that's all I'm going to do, take it or leave it. So I said, okay. I was reluctant. But in any case, she came back for her follow-up visit, and she had written the two paragraphs, and then she wrote a third paragraph, and then a fourth paragraph, and then she couldn't stop, and she ended up with 10 single-spaced pages typed, and after that, her symptoms were 90% better. So and I've used that treatment technique with lots and lots of people. Let's see, other techniques. I like to recommend relaxation technique, which is a specific form of relaxation that works for almost all the different kinds of stress. You get into a comfortable position, lying on a bed or a recliner or on a mat on the floor. You fold your hands on your abdomen, and you breathe deeply enough to that your hands rise and fall. And then you consciously relax each muscle group in your body, starting with the feet and working gradually up to the head. And what that does is the reverse of the stress illness effect. It's using the body to send a signal back to the brain, to tell the brain that everything's okay. And that brings the whole stress level down. If people, spend 10 or 20 minutes doing that two or three times a day, after about 3 weeks, you get pretty good at it. And it's very effective in bringing the overall stress level down. And it's a kindness that you can do for yourself. And any kind of self-care like that makes a big difference.
Dr. Clark, in Chapter 7, you mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy, and there's two parts to it. Could you explain those to us?
Yeah, it's a treatment that has been shown to be effective for anxiety, and it has to do with using relaxation techniques is the behavioral part, and the cognitive part is using the verbal intellectual skills of the mind to, and so you expose somebody to very limited, low anxiety provoking situations while giving them the tools to deal with that, so that you might teach somebody relaxation techniques, and let's say that they are very upset or anxious whenever they're around large numbers of people. And so you might teach them the relaxation technique and then expose them to a small version, a limited version of the anxiety-provoking situation. You might have them go to You know, some of my patients shop for groceries at, you know, all-night markets, and they go in at 1 a.m. because there's nobody around. So you might have the person go at, you know, 9 p.m. when there's more people around and teach them the technique to deal with the anxiety that that's going to provoke. And so you gradually get people used to situations that used to create problems for them. And there's good research that that kind of approach works for many people with anxiety disorders.
Hi, Dr. Clark. This is Chris again. I have a question.
Yeah.
You know, we all have stress in our life on a day-to-day basis, whether it be work, home life. And I'm assuming we all have our own stress level. Is there a way to identify what your stress level may be?
Well, it's a difficult thing to quantify because a level of stress that might seriously affect one person may not affect another person, or a particular stress that might be a serious issue for me, it might not bother somebody else nearly as much. You know, there are standard ways of trying to measure a person's stress response. You can put electrodes on someone's skin and measure the how well the electrical current flows. And the way that works is that if you are under stress, your sweat glands tend to produce sweat, and sweat is a good conductor of electricity, so your skin tends to conduct electricity better when you're under stress. So that's one way of measuring it, but most of us don't want to walk around with electrodes on ourselves all day long. And
that would be stressful if you had to.
Yeah. Even if we did, you know, you could have two people in exactly the same stressful situation, and one of them no problem at all, and the other person might be flying off the handle. So there are so many personal characteristics that become involved here that it's... My hat's off to people who do research in this area.
Yes. Thank you.
You know what is bringing that up? It's Chris and I. He's fine going in the store at 9 p.m. I am very stressed about it. I cannot handle the store at 9 p.m. I don't want to do that therapy.
I understand. That's a very good example. You know, it's... There are, you know, you can start off with, you know, just very minor, you know, changes in your stress level. And if you have good relaxation technique skills, you may find that you can handle that. You know, if your favorite time to go shopping is 1 a.m., but you get, you know, 3 weeks from now, you're really good at relaxation technique, you could try going at midnight and see how that works for you. And then gradually make it earlier over time.
Dr. Clark, I've got a question from one of our listeners from Sherry in Sioux City. She asked, is stress an emotional or biochemical issue, and can it be inherited?
It is both an emotional and a biochemical issue. You know, where do emotions come from? I mean, they come from neural connections in the brain. So it's all connected. The whole basis of my practice is that the brain is a flesh and blood organ like any other, and it's intimately connected to the body, and so we need to understand these things as a whole. Second part of the question was whether it can be inherited, and I definitely believe that it can. I can't quote you research on what percentage of this comes from genetics and what percentage comes from the environment that the person was raised in, but there's going to be clearly an interaction between the two. I mean, if you're if you have a genetic tendency in your family toward reacting badly to stress, that's probably going to play a role in how your mother and father raise you. You know, their own reaction to stress, you're going to feel that as a child growing up. They may, for example, come down on you pretty hard if you cause stress for them. And that, in turn, is going to, you know, make your coping skills more difficult. So lots of complex interactions going on there.
I completely agree. I was raised, my dad just, he didn't deal with stress. He just kind of left the situation alone. My mother is highly overreactive to stressful situations, but somehow actually one of the best job reviews that I ever got in my life was my boss told me that I had very good coping skills.
Yes, and you know, that's one of the great things that I try to point out to people who have survived childhood stress, that it, at least, you know, if you've made it through there, I mean, you have, by surviving that, you have acquired some really tremendous skills, you know, coping skills and attention to detail skills and compassion. And, you know, I try to tell my patients who've come through these things that they have to think of themselves as being heroic, because it's essentially like they were born on the far side of Mount Everest and they had to climb up and over to get to be adults. And they can take a lot of pride in that, because they came through those situations. They did it when they were children. They did it without, you know, basic training to prepare them. They did it without platoon buddies or you know, firehouse mates for moral support. They did it without a break. They did it, you know, without, you know, getting 30 days of paid leave from it. You know, all these things that they did to come through this. That, you know, people we think of as heroes in the adult world never had to cope with. So children who've survived these tremendous difficulties, I think of them as heroic.
I think that's a rough way to gain the skills, but I do agree, and I know several people who have had rough childhoods that do make excellent friends as well as coworkers.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Although, it's, you know, that's true, but I have to also mention that some of my patients who have suffered tremendously with stress illness, their friends and family have no idea how much they're coping with. There's a lot of people out there, you know, people you know well, somebody at the next desk in your office who just may be struggling with all kinds of things, and you might have no idea.
You know, in the book, one of your patients, she's going through a lot of stressful things, and you ask her how her 7-year-old son would handle her situation for a week. I think she was taking care of an ill mother.
I understand the question that you're asking. It's a technique that I often use in my childhood stress survivors. Because many of them have just tremendous skills at taking their emotional reaction they had to being mistreated, and they file it away. They stuff those emotions away. So when they look back, they don't perceive just how bad things really were for them. I've had so many patients who've initially told me, you know, things weren't that bad when I was growing up, you know, nothing really out of the ordinary. But then when you ask specific questions, you find out that things were pretty terrible. But there's a disconnect there. They don't remember things to be as bad as they were, because they've taken all their emotional reaction, and in order to survive their childhood, they had to learn how to put those emotions into a locked box. So what I do to try to help people really perceive how things were is I'll ask them, imagine a child of your own, if they have one, or a child that you care about, growing up in exactly the same home situation that you grew up in, and you are a fly on the wall, and you have to watch that child growing up in that home. How would you feel as you watched that? Would you be okay with it? You know, if your childhood was really just fine, then you should be able to watch another child like that you care about growing up in that same environment and just be, you know, perfectly content to watch that. And a lot of my patients just look at me with horror when I say this. They say, I wouldn't let my kid go through that for 5 minutes. And yet they went through it for 18 years, and that's when they see that there was a lot more that they put up with than they're letting themselves feel.
Wow.
Do you want them to remember? Do you want to bring those memories to the surface?
Yes, because I want them to be able to deal with them with their verbal and intellectual skills, because what's happening to them is that all those emotions are there. They are wanting to be expressed. They are ready to be expressed, but they are not accessible to the verbal part of the brain, and so they are being expressed through the body instead. There's a lot of ways you can express rage. You can yell and scream. You can throw things. You can damage objects. You can damage people. Or you can internalize all that rage and have it go down through your nervous system and into your body, where it can make you really sick. Some of my most extreme patients have been in the hospital vomiting for weeks, to cite the most extreme example. So in order for those symptoms to go away, we have to have them come out in words instead of in physical symptoms. And the way to do that is make somebody see just how bad things were when they were growing up, so they can, if they can't feel the emotion for themselves, they can feel it for another person. And the minute they feel it for another person, they can feel it for themselves. And that's when they can start to talk about it, use their words, use their verbal skills to begin to manage these emotions and express these emotions. And the more you express them in words, written or spoken, the less you have to express them through your body. It works really, really well.
Yeah, that made me think. When you put it like that, I've never really thought about my childhood as bad before, but there are a few things that, when you posed the question to me like that, it did kind of make me think. Now, I've got one more question before we let you go for the night, Dr. Clark.
Okay.
What do you think can be done to improve our healthcare system so that stress illness is diagnosed and treated correctly?
Well, I'm at the moment traveling around the country speaking at teaching hospitals all over the United States to help doctors know what questions to ask and what to do with the answers. I think that's a key step. I would also love to see wider adoption of a technique that we've used in my private practice group, which is to have people that I call stress medicine specialists. These are people with master's degrees in a mental health field who are working right alongside the doctors in a primary care medical office. And as soon as someone with stress illness is identified by the doctor, they can turn them right over to this person who's right there in the office, and just as part of the whole primary care visit. And that person is going to be able to take over and begin working on the stress illness issues in more depth, because they've got the background and the training. And then, frankly, that's what they love to do. That's their primary interest. So combining those two people in a single office visit, you get the mind and the body both at the same time. To me, that's likely to be the best long-term solution.
That's great. All great suggestions, all great ideas. Dr. Clark, I'd like to thank you for visiting with us tonight. And if anybody in our audience would like to learn more about Dr. Clark and his book, They Can't Find Anything Wrong, you can find him on stressillness.com. And he's also linked up to our website, which is NutraSounds.com, and also on BBSRadio.com. And if you have any, Dr. Clark, where can they find your book in the bookstores?
Well, it's available in the online booksellers, and it's coming through the pipeline to most regular chain bookstores. I was out in the Borders and Creve Coeur today, and they've got a whole bunch of them there.
Okay, great. And I think you're up on Amazon.com as well.
Yes, I definitely am.
Okay, well, great. Okay, well, thank you for a great show tonight. Nikki and Chris, I'd like to thank you. If you have any questions and like to reach us directly, you can call our office at 740-698-9119. And we look forward to seeing you next week, tomorrow night, on Vocal Profiling Live. Sherry will be returning, and we'll talk with her then, and we like to look forward to next week's show. Thank you, Dr. Clark.
Hey, thank you, Heather, Nikki, and Chris. You guys asked very insightful questions, and I appreciate it.
Hey, we loved your book.
Thank you.
Great book.
Thank you very much.